This is Audible.
Beach Music by Pat Conroy. Copyright 1995 by Pat Conroy. This recording of the full-length reading of Beach Music was published by arrangement with Doubleday, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group, Incorporated, and was produced in 1995 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by Jonathan Mayrose. Prologue. In 1980, a year after my wife leapt to her death from the Silas Perlman Bridge in Charleston, South Carolina, I moved to Italy to begin life anew, taking our small daughter with me. Our sweet Leah was not quite two when my wife, Shyla, stopped her car on the highest point of the bridge and looked over, for the last time, the city she loved so well. She had put on the emergency brake and opened the door of our car, then lifted herself up to the rail of the bridge with the delicacy and enigmatic grace that was always Shyla's cat-like gift. She was also quick-witted and funny, but she carried within her a dark side that she hid with bright illusions and an irony as finely wrought as lace. She had so mastered the strategies of camouflage that her own history had seemed a series of well-placed mirrors that kept her hidden from herself. It was nearly sunset, and a tape of the Drifters' greatest hits poured out of the car's stereo. She had recently had our car serviced, and the gasoline tank was full. She had paid all the bills and set up an appointment with Dr. Joseph for my teeth to be cleaned. Even in her final moments, her instincts tended toward the orderly and the functional. She had always prided herself in keeping her madness invisible and at bay, and when she could no longer fend off the voices that grew inside her, their evil set to chaos in a minor key, her breakdown enfolded upon her, like a tarpaulin pulled across that part of her brain where once there had been light. Having served her time in mental hospitals, exhausted the wide range of pharmaceuticals, and submitted herself to the priestly rites of therapists of every theoretic persuasion, she was defenseless when the black music of her subconscious sounded its elegy for her time on earth. On the rail, all eyewitnesses agreed, Shyla hesitated and looked out toward the sea and shipping lanes that cut past Fort Sumter, trying to compose herself for the last action of her life. Her beauty had always been a disquieting thing about her, and as the wind from the sea caught her black hair, lifting it like streamers behind her, no one could understand why anyone so lovely would want to take her own life. But Shyla was tired of feeling ill-made and transitory, and she wanted to set the flags of all her tomorrows at half-mast. 3 days earlier, she had disappeared from our house in Ansonborough, and only later did I discover that she had checked into the Mills Hyatt House to put her affairs in order. After making appointments, writing schedules, letters, and notes that would allow our household to continue in its predictable harmony, she marked the mirror in her hotel room with an annulling X in bright red lipstick, paid her bill with cash, flirted with the doorman, and gave a large tip to the boy who brought her the car. The staff at the hotel remarked on her cheerfulness and composure during her stay. As Shyla steadied herself on the rail of the bridge, a man approached her from behind, a man coming up from Florida, besotted with citrus and Disney World, and said in a low voice, so as not to frighten the comely stranger on the bridge, "Are you okay, honey?" She pirouetted slowly and faced him. Then, with tears streaming down her face, she stepped back, and with that step, changed the lives of her family forever. Her death surprised no one who loved her, yet none of us got over it completely. Shyla was that rarest of suicides. No one held her responsible for the act itself. She was forgiven as instantly as she was missed, and afterward she was deeply mourned. For 3 days I joined the grim-faced crew of volunteers who searched for Shala's remains. Ceaselessly we dragged the length and breadth of the harbor, enacting a grotesque form of braille as hooks felt their way along the mudflats and the pylons of the old bridge that connected Mount Pleasant and Sullivan's Island. Two boys were crabbing when they noticed her body moving toward them beside the marsh grass. After her funeral, a sadness took over me that seemed permanent, and I lost myself in the details and technicalities connected to death in the South. Great sorrow still needs to be fed, and I dealt with my disconsolate emptiness by feeding everyone who gathered around me to offer their support. I felt as though I were providing sustenance for the entire army in the field, who had come together to ease the malignant ache I felt every time Shala's name was mentioned. The word Shala itself became a landmine. That sweet-sounding word was merciless, and I could not bear to hear it. So I lost myself in the oils and condiments of my well-stocked kitchen. I fatted up my friends and family, attempted complicated recipes I had always put off making, and even tried my hand at Asian cuisine for the first time. With 6 gas burners ablaze, I turned out velvety soups and rib-sticking stews. I alternated between cooking and weeping, and I prayed for the repose of the soul of my sad, hurt wife. I suffered, I grieved, I broke down, and I cooked fabulous meals for those who came to comfort me. It was only a short time after we buried Shala that her parents sued me for custody of my child, Leah, and their lawsuit brought me running back into the real world. I spent a dispiriting year in court trying to prove my fitness as a father. It was a time when I met a series of reptilian lawyers so unscrupulous that I would not have used their marrow to feed wild dogs or their wiry flesh to bait a crab pot. Shala's mother and father had gone crazy with grief, and I learned much about the power of scapegoating by watching their quiet hatred of me as they grimaced through the testimony regarding my sanity, my finances, my reputation in the community, and my sexual life with their eldest child. Though I have a whole range of faults that piqued the curiosity of the court, few who have ever seen me with my daughter have any doubts about my feelings for her. I get weak at the knees at the very sight of her. She is my certification, my boarding pass into the family of man, and whatever faith in the future I still retain. But it was not my overriding love of Leah that won the day in court. Before she took her final drive, Shala had mailed me a letter that was part love letter and part apology for what she had done. When my lawyer had me read that letter aloud to the court, it became clear to Shala's parents and everyone present that laying her death at my feet was, at best, a miscarriage of justice. Her letter was an act of extraordinary generosity, written in the blackest hours of her life. She blew it like a kiss toward me as a final gesture of a rare, exquisite sensibility. Her letter saved Leah for me, but the ferocity of that court battle left me exhausted, bitter, and raw around the edges. It felt as though Shala had died twice. I answered my wife's leap from the bridge and the fierceness of that legal battle with a time of disorientation and sadness, and then with Italy. Toward Europe I looked for respite and hermitage, and the imminence of my secret flight from South Carolina again restored a fighting spirit within me. I had made a good living as a food and travel writer, and running away had always been one of the things I did best. The flight to Europe was my attempt to place the memory of both Shala and South Carolina permanently in the past. I hoped I would save my life and Leah's from the suffocation I was beginning to feel in the place where Shala and I had come of age together. For me, the South was carry-on baggage I could not shed no matter how many borders I crossed, but my daughter was still a child, and I wanted her to grow into young womanhood as a European, blissfully unaware of that soft, ruinous South that had killed her mother in one of its prettiest rivers. My many duties as a father I took with great seriousness, but there was no law that I was aware of that insisted I raise Leah as a Southerner. Certainly the South had been a mixed blessing for me, and I carried some grievous wounds into exile with me. All the way across the Atlantic, Leah slept in my lap, and when she awoke, I began her transformation by teaching her to count in Italian. And so, in Rome, we settled and began the long process of refusing to be Southern, even though my mother started a letter-writing campaign to coax me back home. Her letters arrived every Friday. A Southerner in Rome? A low country boy in Italy? Ridiculous. You've always been restless, Jack. Never knew how to be comfortable with your own kind. But mark my words, you'll be back soon. The South's got a lot wrong with it, but it's permanent press and it doesn't wash out. Though my mother was onto something real, I stuck by my guns. I would tell American tourists who questioned me about my accent that I no longer checked the scores of the Atlanta Braves and the Herald Tribune, and they could not get me to reread Faulkner or Miss Eudora at gunpoint. I did not realize or care that I was attempting to expunge all that was most authentic about me. I was serious about needing some time to heal and giving my soul a much-needed rest. My quest was amnesia. My vehicle was Rome. For 5 years, my plan worked very well. But no one walks out of his family without reprisals. A family is too disciplined an army to offer compassion to its deserters. No matter how much they sympathized with all my motives, those who loved me most read a clear text of treason in my action. They thought that by forcing me away from South Carolina, Shiloh's leap had succeeded in taking Leah and me over the rail with her. I understood completely, but I was so burnt out I did not care. I threw myself at the Italian language with gusto and became fluent in the street talk of the shopkeepers and the vendors of our neighborhood. In the first year of our exile, working all the angles of my trade, I completed my third cookbook, a compilation of recipes I had gathered over a 10-year career of dining out in some of the best restaurants in the South. I also wrote a travel book on Rome that became popular with American tourists as soon as it hit the Giornali. I urged every American who read it to understand Rome was both sublime and imperishably beautiful, a city that melted into leaf-blown silences and gave a splendid return to any tourist adventurous enough to stray from the main trade routes of tourism. All the pangs and difficulties of my own homesickness went into the writing of that book. The artfully hidden subtext in those first years was that foreign travel was worth every discomfort and foul-up, but took a radical toll on the spirit. Though I could write about the imperishable charms of Rome forever, I could not quiet that pearly ache in my heart that I diagnosed as the cry of home. I kept that cry to myself, in fact, did not even admit that it was something I heard or felt. I concentrated on the task of raising Leah in a culture alien to me, and I hired a maid named Maria Parise from the Umbrian countryside and watched with pleasure as she took over the task of mothering Leah. Maria was a simple, strong-willed woman, God-fearing and superstitious, as only a peasant can be, who brought an undiminishable joy to the raising of this small, motherless American. In a short amount of time, Leah became part of the native fauna around the Palazzo Farnese, a beloved Romanina adopted by the people who lived and plied their trades around the piazza, and she rapidly turned into the first real linguist produced by my family. Her Italian was flawless as she navigated the teeming stalls along the Campo dei Fiori with its wild rivers of fruit and cheese and olives. Very early on, I taught Leah how to tell where we were in the Campo by using her sense of smell. The south side was glazed with the smell of slain fish, and no amount of water or broom work could ever eliminate the tincture of ammonia sent in that part of the piazza. The fish had written their names in those stones. But so had the young lambs and the coffee beans and the torn arugula and the glistening tears of citrus and the bread bacon that produced a golden brown perfume from the great ovens. I whispered to Leah that a sense of smell was better than a yearbook for imprinting the delicate graffiti of time in the memory. I knew that Leah had developed a bloodhound's nose when, in the middle of the second year, she stopped me as we passed the Ruggeri brothers' alimentari and said, "The truffles have arrived, Daddy, they're here," as I caught that signature odor of pure earth. As a reward, I bought Leah a fraction of that truffle, priced as dearly as uranium, and sliced it into her scrambled eggs the next morning. The raising of Leah consumed a large portion of my days and made me place my own sorrow over the loss of Shiloh in a seldom-visited back lot of my life, allowing me no time to devote to my own complex feelings over her death. Leah's happiness superseded everything in my life, and I was determined I would not pass our family's infinite capacity for suffering on to her. I knew that Leah, as Shiloh's child and my own, would get more than her portion of the genes of grief. Together our families contained enough sad stories to jumpstart a colony of lemmings toward the nearest body of water. I had no idea if the seeds of our madness burned in secret deposits in my beautiful child's bloodstream or not, but I vowed to protect her from those stories, from both sides of her family, that could set in motion the forces that had brought me, spiritually bloody and beaten, to the Fiumicino airport in the first place. I confess that I became the censor of my daughter's history. The South that I described to Leah at bedtime every night existed only in my imagination. It admitted no signs of danger or nightmare. There was no dark side to the southern moon that I recalled to my daughter, and the rivers ran clean and the camellias were always in bloom. It was a South that existed without sting or thorns or heartache. Because I have inherited my family's gift for storytelling, my well-told lies became Leah's memories. Without realizing it, I made the mistake of turning South Carolina into a lost and secret paradise to my daughter. By carefully editing what I thought would harm her, I turned my childhood into something as glamorous as forbidden fruit. Though Rome would mark her with its most exacting emblems, I did not note the exact moment I touched my child with a lust to see the fierce, rarefied beauty of her birthplace. Even as Leah became part of the secrets that Rome whispered, she was not a native of the city, not indigenous like the flowery lichens that grew along the wall that held back the Tiber. Almost every night in Rome, when I put Leah to bed, I would tell her a different story about either my or her mother's childhood. But there was one story she had me tell and retell over and over until it took on a fixed, by-the-numbers quality as rote as a catechist's response. Again and again she would have me repeat the story of the night that Shiloh and I first fell in love. Though we had grown up in houses that backed up to each other, had played together as toddlers, had waved back and forth from our bedroom windows, we had rarely thought of ourselves as anything other than best pals. I came from a family of five brothers, and Shiloh was the closest thing to a sister I ever had. Until the night on the beach in our senior year, when Shiloh approached me in a most unsisterly fashion. "I bet you flirted with Mama first," Leah would say. "I did not," I said. "I was shy." "Then why aren't you shy now?" she teased. "Because your mother helped me make a delightful discovery," I said, "that I had a terrific personality."
"Even in high school?"
Leah laughed, knowing the answer. "I didn't have a personality in high school," I said. "I had pimples."
"But you dated Ladare Ansley, the class goddess, the head cheerleader," Leah said.
"Well, she was shy, too, though no one thinks a pretty girl has any right to be bashful. Because we were both afraid of everything, we made a perfect team."
"Her mother didn't like you at all," Leah said.
"She thought Ladare could do a lot better," I said. "She had a way of looking at me when I picked up Ladare as though I were a urine sample."
"You are always so crude," said Leah. "But you get mad at me if I'm crude ever."
"I never get mad at you. My job is to adore you. I find it easy."
"Well, go on with the story. Tell me about you and Mama falling in love. Get to the good part, to the beach party. Get to Mama, Capers, Middleton, Mike, and Jordan."
As I spoke, my voice crossing the years and the Atlantic, Leah would always look at the photograph of her lovely, wide-eyed mother that rested on the bedside table. I knew that the story made her love her mother more deeply, feel closer to her in a way nothing else could, and it was just what I intended. I first fell in love with Shiloh Fox, a girl I had known my whole life, on St. George's Island.
"It was St. Michael's Island," Leah corrected. "It's the island just before the Isle of Orion, where your mama lives now."
"That's right," I said, always pleased by her attention to detail. "A friend of mine was throwing a party at his father's house."
"It was Capers Middleton. His father owned the Coca-Cola Bottling Company in Waterford. He lived in the nicest mansion on Bay Street."
"Good girl. His father owned the beach house."
"And Mama had dated Capers and a lot of other boys. She was real popular in high school, the sweetheart of Waterford High School. but Capers had brought her to the party.
"Are you going to tell this story, or are you going to let me?" I asked.
"You, I love the way you tell it," Leah said, her eyes resting again on her mother's picture.
Then I would begin in earnest, going back to St. Michael's Island during that storm-tossed year of northeast winds, when the erosion along the barrier islands reached dangerous levels. On the shifting, undermined beach, where part of an ancient forest was newly underwater to the north, the baseball team of Waterford High was throwing a party at high tide. It was the night it was predicted the Middleton house would begin to break up and fall into the sea. Four houses, a mile to the south, had been lost during the last spring tides. Though the house was condemned and abandoned, we were giving it a going-away party. Already it had begun to shift seaward, to lean toward the chaste silver of the incoming breakers. The surf kept time to our dancing and counted out loud the slipping away of those last hours we would ever be teenagers. All of us had been there at the birth of rock and roll, and we had done our part in putting rhythm and desire to music as we danced our way in both wildness and innocence through high school. The authorities declared the house off-limits, and we had broken through the sheriff's lock and liberated the house for one last party at flood tide. I was almost 18 and still in possession of that crazy edge of a teenager. Full of bravado and maker's mark, I had boasted that I was going to be in that house when it set sail from its anchorage on the old seaside road. Ladere Ansley, my date, had too much horse sense to stay in that tilted house, illuminated only by the headlights of cars my teammates had driven to the party. On the way to the island, Ladere had told me sweetly that it was time we begin seeing other people, that her parents were insisting that we break up soon after graduation. I nodded my head, not in agreement, but because I had not yet found my voice, which lay hidden under a hormonal frenzy that struck me nearly dumb. She also confided in me that she was going to ask Capers Middleton to accompany her to her debut at Charleston's St. Cecilia Society's ball. My origins were iffy and much rougher than Ladere's, and my mother had warned me for years that this night was coming, but she'd never told me it would hurt as badly as it did. The whole team and their dates had begun the night dancing to the music of transistor radios, the local station, WBEU, playing all the songs that had accompanied our class through 4 years of high school. The sea rose invisibly beneath us, and the moon shone smooth and bright. A glossy flute of light, like velvet down a bridal aisle, lit the marlin scales and the backs of whales migrating 100 miles at sea. The tides surged through the marsh, and each wave that hit the beach came light-struck and broad-shouldered, with all the raw power the moon could bestow. Magically, an hour passed, and we, ocean dancers and tide challengers, found ourselves listening to the sea directly beneath us as the waves began to crash in earnest against the house. Previous tides had already loosened the pilings and foundations, pressing the house into the sands. When the noise of the surge and the breakup of concrete and wood grew too loud, many of my teammates and their dates broke prudently and ran for the line of cars and safety, as the water continued to rise beyond all believing. This great tide would eventually rise just over 8 feet, and it looked as though it meant to overwhelm the whole island. More and more of the dancers broke and ran, laughing, as the sea began to take the house apart from below. The salt-rusted nails were moaning like cellos in the grain of endangered wood. I was in the middle of doing the shag to Annie Had a Baby when a wave tore off the banister of the front porch, and I lost my partner, Ladere Ansley, who fled outside with most of the others, squealing with fear and wearing my letterman's jacket. Left alone, I took my pint of Maker's Mark up to the top floor and went out onto the deck just off the master bedroom. I stood face to face with the moon and the ocean and the future that spread out with all its bewildering immensity before me. It was a time in my life when many things bored me deeply, and I hungered for beauty and those realms of pure elation granted to those who had the imagination to know what to look for and how to find it.
It was one of the reasons I loved playing right field for the baseball team during that long season, as we sparred on the immaculate fields in the sheer beauty of the game's discipline, a law unto itself. Right field was a home place for thinkers if you had the arm to keep the Swift boys from going from first to third on a double. I had the arm and the mineral patience of the daydreamer, and I roamed the outfield green, lamb happy, and nervous when southpaws came to the plate. A door opened behind me. "Mama!" Leah squealed. I looked around to see Shyla Fox in the moonlight. She looked as though she had dressed for this moment with the help of the moon. Bowing deeply, Shyla asked me if she could have the pleasure of this dance. So we danced toward the central motion of our lives. The winds roared, and a strange love rose like a tide between us and rested in the crown of waves that was loosening the frame of the house. Alone we danced beneath the full moon and the battery-powered light of cars, as the team and their dates cheered each time they saw the giant shift taking place in the water-damaged foundation. As the Atlantic waters rose in a sanctioned dance of wave and tide, the house began to sway like the first terrible lifting of Noah's Ark. We could hear the other five remaining couples as they screamed with pleasure and terror in that room directly beneath us. I held Shyla closely, dancing with the girl who had taught me how to dance on the veranda of my house. Outside, the players and their dates were begging us to abandon the foundering house and join them at the driftwood fires. They screamed out of worry and honked their car horns out of pure admiration for our daring. Then the house shuddered as a large wave struck its cinder block foundation. Though I felt that same chilling fear that had sent the others running out of the house, Shyla's eyes held me as we listened to the hammering of the waves beneath us. The cries of our friends now turned to pleas each time a wave washed down over the broken-up road, the salt spray exploding off the beaten-down tarmac that had eroded over time like a cookie half-eaten by a child. A deck piling snapped outside, loud as a rifle shot. On the radio, the Drifters began to sing "Save the Last Dance for Me." Together, as though this scene had long been choreographed in some zodiacal prophecy, we said together and with no hesitation, "My favorite song." From first note to last, we danced the song that became ours at that very moment. We were silent above the lapping waters as I spun her into the changed shape of a girl who looked at me as none other had. Before her eyes, I felt like a prince fresh born on the crests of the light-driven waves. She granted me a beauty I did not have, and my soul turned proud in the fury of her centered wanting of me. Watching, I felt her ardor creating something glittering and good from my heart. It was then that she led me into the bedroom, and I found myself on the torn carpet with Shiloh's lips pressed against mine, her tongue against my tongue, and I heard the fierceness and urgency of her whisper, "Fall in love with me, Jack. I dare you to fall in love with me." Before I could answer, I heard the house shudder once again and push off as it took its first primal step toward the sea. The house tilted, then fell forward as though it were prostrating itself before the power of this once-in-a-lifetime tidal surge. It felt as though a mountain were trying to rise up beneath us. We left the rug and went out to the newly imbalanced balcony, holding hands to steady ourselves. The moon lit the sea in a freeway of papery light, and we watched the boiling whitecaps feeding on the broken cement scattered beneath the house. We continued to dance while the house kept its appointment with the long tide, and I blazed with the love of this young girl. Our love began and ended with seawater. Later, I would often wish that Shyla and I had entered into a lover's pact that night and remained in that water-damaged house, enclosed in each other's arms, and had let the ocean pour through the open windows until we rose in some invisible withdrawal and allowed the sea to pull us in a death clench out toward the Gulf Stream and beyond all hurt of history. When I saw Shyla last, I identified her broken body at the city morgue with the Charleston coroner in attendance.
He was a man of great compassion, and he left me alone as I wept over her all but unrecognizable form. I prayed out Catholic prayers over her, because they were the only ones I knew, and they came as easily as tears, if only half remembered. She was bloated from her time in the water, leaving all signs of her prettiness in the shallows of the harbor, and the crabs had done their work. Something caught my eye as I rose to leave her, and I bent down and turned her arm. On her left forearm was tattooed the number 3636404. "It was recently done," the coroner said quietly. "Any idea why?" "Her father was at Auschwitz," I said. "It's his number." "That's a first," he said. "You think you've seen everything here, but that's certainly a first. Odd. Was she very close to her father?" "Not at all. They barely spoke." "You going to tell the daddy about the tattoo?" "No, it'd kill him," I said, looking at Shiloh's body for the last time. My name is Jack McCall, and I fled to Rome to raise my daughter in peace. Now, in 1985, as I went up the spiral staircase that led to my terrace and a rooftop view of Rome, I took a music box that Shiloh had given me as a present on our 5th wedding anniversary. Winding it, I looked over the Roman night. Far off, a bell struck, sounding much like a lost angel, and a breeze came off the Tiber. The music box played Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21, one of my favorite pieces of music in the world. The air was heavy with the dinner smells rising from Air Gigetto's restaurant below, grilled lamb, mint leaves, and sage. I closed my eyes and saw Shiloh's face again. From inside the music box, I took the letter she had mailed to me on the day of her death and looked at how she had written my name. Her handwriting was pretty, and she took special care whenever she put my name on paper. I thought about reading it again, but instead I listened to the traffic moving past the Tiber and lifted the gold necklace from the music box. It had been a gift from her mother, received at her Sweet 16 party, and she had never taken it off until that final day. The necklace had become part of my memory of our lovemaking. In her will, Shiloh made it clear she wanted Leah to wear it when she was old enough to understand the nature of the gift. Shiloh's parents had asked for the return of the necklace when they sued me for custody of my child. Because it seemed like such a talisman of evil and bad luck to me, I had often thought of mailing it to them with no note or return address. It was only a necklace to me that night, and I put it back in the music box. Though I did not know it as I scanned the passerby moving down below, I was in the middle of a year that would change my life forever. Part 1. Chapter 1. I am usually up when the Piazza Farnese awakens. In darkness, I brew my coffee and take a cup up to the terrace, where I watch first light come over the deer-colored city. At 6 in the morning, the man at the newspaper stand arrives and begins arranging magazines beneath his canopy. Then a truck enters the piazza from the west, carrying bales of Il Messaggero and other morning papers. The two carabinieri who guard the entrance to the French embassy switch on the lights of their jeep to begin their slow, perfunctory circling of the Palazzo Farnese. Wearing the same expressions, like face cards in a disfigured deck, the carabinieri seem bored, and usually you can see the pale glow of their cigarettes against the dashboards as they sit in their cars during the long Roman night. A van carrying fragrant bags of coffee then arrives in front of the Bon Café, at the same time the owner of the café rolls up the steel shutters. His first cup of coffee always goes to the driver of the truck, the second to the owner of the newspaper stand. A small boy, the son of the owner, then takes two cups of black coffee to the carabinieri across the piazza, just as the nuns in Santa Brigida begin to stir in the convent across from my building. While it is still dark beneath the annealed stars and low-seated moon, a nun opens the small steel gate in front of the church of Santa Brigida, an act signifying that Mass is about to start. There is solitude in the fatigue of watching such beginnings, and I then ritually count the 13 churches I can see from my terrace. I was still counting them when I spotted a man who had been following us for the last few days enter the piazza from the Campo dei Fiori. I slipped behind an oleander bush as the man looked up toward my terrace, then entered the Bon Café. I continued to count the bell towers and the four great moony clocks, whose hands commemorated the exact moment of their death for Rome to see. I listened with pleasure to the music of the fountains in the piazza. Across the piazza, a nun moved on the church's terrace this Monday morning, heedless as a moth in her mothering of roses. A brindled cat stalked a pigeon into the first slice of sunlight in the piazza, but a bum clapped his hands and shooed them both away. The man who'd been following me came out of the Bon Café and looked my way again. He lit a cigarette, then walked to the newspaper stand and bought a copy of Il Messaggero. Below me, the piazza began to bloom with life as carts rolled into it and pedestrians entered from the side streets. Pigeons called to each other from the stately rows of fleur-de-lis that stretched along the entablature of the French embassy. I love both the regularity and austereness of my piazza. At 7 a.m. on this day, the roofers returned to work on the apartment across the alley, replacing the old rows of ceramic tile with new ones, creating a strange music of nails against tiles that sounded like the playing of xylophones underwater. I finished my coffee and went down to wake up Leah for school. As I walked over to her window and opened the shutter, Leah asked, "Is that man still watching for us, Daddy?" "He's waiting for us in the piazza, just like before." "Who do you think he is?" she asked. "I'll find out today, sweetheart." "What if he's a kidnapper? Maybe he'll sell me to the gypsies, and I'll have to make a living robbing tourists." "You've been talking to Maria again. Now don't listen to her about gypsies or about communists. Hurry up now. Get ready for school. Sua Rosaria always blames me if you're late." "What if he tries to hurt me, Daddy?" I lifted my daughter up into the air until we were looking at each other eye to eye. "I told you before, your daddy may be stupid, but what else am I?" "Big," she giggled. "How big?" "Real big. You're 6 feet 6 inches tall." "What do the kids in your school call me?" "They call you Il Gigante, the giant," she said, laughing again. "I'm the giant, and the guy down there's the little midget who climbs up the beanstalk."
"But the little midget kills the giant by chopping down the beanstalk," she said.
I hugged her and laughed. "You're smarter than hell, Leah, just like your mama. Don't worry, that was a fairy tale. In real life, giants clean their teeth with the leg bones of guys like that."
"That's disgusting. I'm going to brush my teeth."
I heard Maria let herself in through the front door and call out, "Buongiorno, piccolina," to Leah as she passed in the hallway. Maria stored her umbrella in the front closet, then came to the kitchen where I poured her a cup of coffee.
"Buongiorno, dottore," Maria said.
"I'm not a doctor, Maria," I answered in my own formal Italian. I am unable to master Maria's dialect. It sounds like part chirrupin' and part speech impediment, but she has never grown impatient when I have trouble understanding her.
"In Italy you're a doctor," she said in Italian. "So enjoy it and hold your tongue. I love calling you dottore in front of the other maids. They know I work for a man of leisure. By the way, your friend is still there."
"I saw him from the terrace. Does anyone know him?"
"The portieri talked to the owner of the Bon Café.
The stranger says he's a tourist from Milano. But why would a tourist look only at this apartment and ignore the Palazzo Farnese?
Bruno at the newsstand says that he's sure the man is a policeman and that you must be involved with drugs or the Red Brigades. None of the carabinieri have ever seen him, but they're too young to have seen anyone but their mothers. He buys cigarettes in the cartoleria from Janina. The whole piazza is watching him. He does not seem dangerous. They said to tell you not to fear."
"Tell them thanks. I'll try to repay them."
"No need," she answered. "Even though you and La Piccolina are foreigners, you are part of the piazza. Everyone watches out for his neighbor."
"Marry me, Maria," I said, taking hold of her hand. "Marry me and I'll give you my money and let you raise my child."
"You speak foolishness to me, sciocchese," Maria said,
giggling madly and jerking her hand away. "Americano pazzo, you tease me too much, and one day I say yes, and what will you do, dottore?"
"Call the Pope and tell him to get his ass over to Santo Pietro for a wedding ceremony."
"You are too big for me, Signor McCall," she said, appraising me. "You would kill me in bed."
"Excuses, excuses," I replied, as Leah appeared in the kitchen doorway, already dressed for school. She smiled broadly so I could inspect her carefully brushed teeth. I went over, checked her ears and neck, and, nodding approval, I sent her toward Maria, who began to put the child's hair in pigtails. Leah's hair was a dark wave that kindled beneath the electric light. When she shook it, it shimmered, roiled like something half-animal, half-river.
"Bellissima, bellissima," Maria sang as she twisted Leah's hair into fine braids. "Prettiest little girl in the piazza."
The Piazza Farnese was the central fact of Leah's life. She was blissfully unaware that I was on the run from a past that had put too many hunters in the field against me. She did not remember the flight out of South Carolina to New York, or the night flight on Alitalia that brought us to Rome. She squeezed my hand as we said good morning to the portiere and stepped out into the bright light. The waiting man turned his back and lit another cigarette. Then he pretended to read a historical marker placed just above the door of the pharmacia.
"You won't fight him, will you, Daddy?" Leah asked.
"You've got my word I won't fight him. You think I'm stupid, after what happened last time?"
"It scared me when you went to jail," she said.
"Not half as badly as it scared me. Rome ended your daddy's boxing career."
"All the nuns know you were in prison at Regina Coeli," she said, with great 8-year-old disapproval. "Even Suor Rosaria, it's very embarrassing."
"It was a cultural misunderstanding," I explained as we walked through the crowded piazza. "Il Gigante thought he had to kick ass. It was an error in judgment that any American could have made."
"You owe me 1,000 lira, Leah said.
"I didn't say a cuss word. I don't owe you a dime."
"You said the A word. That's 1,000 lira.
"Ass is not a cuss word. It means a small donkey, and it comes from the Bible. Let's see. They rode Jesus through the city seated on a small ass."
"That's not how you use the word," she said. "If you're fair about it, you'll give me 1,000 lira.
"I'm an adult," I said. "It's part of my job description to be totally unfair to every child I meet."
"I was in prison with you," Leah said primly. "Suor Rosaria thinks you ought to be ashamed of yourself."
"I was victimized by a male-dominated society that didn't understand me."
"You were a brute," said Leah.
Anytime I lost my temper, raised my voice, or found myself in a situation that contained the seeds of discord, Leah would remind me of my most contentious encounter with the habits and customs of Italy. It happened in our first months in Rome, when I was still acclimating myself to the myriad responsibilities a man encountered trying to raise a child single-handedly in a foreign city. Every day I found myself overwhelmed by the sheer variety of needs and wants manufactured by this simple child. Leah made me feel as though I required the skills of a city manager to move her through all the maze-like conundrums that Rome could throw up in our paths. Through an act of faith, I had discovered the right pediatrician. To get a telephone installed required 3 trips to City Hall, 4 to the telephone company, 3 bribes of hard cash, and a case of good wine to the portiere, who knew the brother of a friend who lived next door to the mayor of Rome. The city prided itself on the extremism of its inefficiency. Its good-natured anarchy left me exhausted at the end of each day. But I had encountered no trouble in Rome until I relaxed my guard and found myself shopping near midday beneath the canopies that shaded those fabulous fruit and vegetable stands in the Campo dei Fiori. As I led my daughter through that squawking aviary of human commerce, I loved to study the vast tiers of fruit with the wasps sipping the nectar of plums and yellow jackets happy as puppies among the grapes and peaches. Pointing out the wasps to Leah, I admired out loud the accord that existed between the wasps and vendors, as if they had signed a treaty of entente to underscore their partnership in the business of selling and eating fruit. The sheer theater of the street life in the Campo enthralled Leah from our first week in the neighborhood. Each day, we would drift from the North End, where we bought bread, to our last stop at Fratelli Ruggeri, whose shop smelled of cheese and pork, and whose ceiling was hung with 50 legs of prosciutto. Huge wheels of Parmesan cheese, as large as truck tires, were rolled out from the back. There were 5 brothers, and each brother had a unique and tragic personality, as though they had bit parts in 5 different operas. Each was a law unto himself, and they lent a note of improvisation and theater to the selling of their fragrant produce. It was outside of their store that I ran into trouble when I remembered I had forgotten to buy olives. As Leah and I again walked the length of the Campo, past the knife sharpener on his stationary bicycle and the booths that sold lungs and offal, we ran straight into one of those fire-breathing marital scraps of the D'Angelo couple. Though it took us a while to learn their names, I had witnessed several fights between Mimo and Sofia D'Angelo before in the Piazza Farnese. Mimo was a laborer and an alcoholic, and could often be seen with a bottle of grappa drinking alone on the stone bench that ran for 50 meters across the front of the palazzo. He was stocky and built low to the ground, with hairy shoulders and thick, powerful arms. When sitting in the piazza drinking grappa from the bottle, he seemed to grow dark rather than drunk. Once the darkness came, he began muttering expletives at everything about his life that he found disappointing. His wife would generally come upon him in this condition, and their screaming at each other was loud enough to be heard by pedestrians walking along the Tiber and those coming out of the Piazza Navona. Whatever protocols the D'Angelos kept in the privacy of their apartment did not apply to their violent public encounters. Leah and I had watched several of them from our window high over the piazza, and for sheer volume and quality of invective, this Roman couple were in a class by themselves. The quarrels usually ended with a distraught and weeping Sophia breaking into a shameful run back to her home after realizing that the whole piazza was listening to and thoroughly enjoying the couple's histrionics. "He's mean," Leah had said. "Italians don't hit," I assured her. "They just yell." But these domestic quarrels between the D'Angelos began to grow in frequency and decibels. Sophia was pretty and theatrical and 10 years younger than her hard, inattentive husband. Her legs were beautiful, her figure full, and her eyes brimmed with pain. Each day Mimo drank more and Sophia wept more, and their level of language became more charged with the ancient sorrow of the poor and the hopeless. Maria told me Mimo was threatening to kill Sophia because she'd shamed him among his neighbors, and that a man was nothing if he lost his sense of honor before his friends and countrymen. None of this should have had the slightest importance in my life. The D'Angelos were local color, a troubling coda in the war between the sexes, one I was grateful had nothing to do with me. But on that particular day, our first year in Rome, I was buying olives from the olive vendor, a grumpy, unsunny man, whom I was beginning to like for the originality of his sullenness, when I heard Leah scream. I looked up as a punch landed against Sophia's cheek. It was not the blood that ignited my temper, nor the tears, nor the pleading. It was the deep pity I felt when I saw the terror in Sophia's eyes, and the hopelessness I had seen so often as a child. But I was not out of control when I approached Mimo, and was very aware that I was in a foreign country where the customs were unfamiliar and my interference might be fiercely resented. Mimo was about to strike again, but I grabbed his arm. Mimo went berserk when he saw me interfering in his disciplining of his wife. He tried to hit me with his free hand, but I deflected the blow and held both of Mimo's arms to his side. "No, signore," I said respectfully in my halting Italian. "E mallo." Mimo let loose with a salvo of Italian profanity that would help clarify the graffiti written on the walls and bridges around Rome when I later was exploring the margins of the old city with Leah. I caught the word morte, which made me think that Mimo was threatening murder, and the word stronzo, which was an all-inclusive street term roughly equivalent to asshole. Mimo freed one arm and threw a roundhouse punch at my chin,
but I caught the arm again and lifted Mimo off his feet, slamming him firmly against the wall of the bakery. People had begun screaming, and when I looked down, I saw Leah's terrified face. Worried for her, I tried to find a way to extricate myself gently from a scene that was assuming the dimensions of grand opera. Then Mimo spat in my face, and for a brief moment I thought about tearing the man's head off. But again I saw my daughter and knew that I had to disengage and do it quickly before the police came. I placed Mimo on the ground near Sophia, who had begun to scream at me to put her husband down. Then I picked up Leah and said, "Mi dispiace," to Mimo and his wife several times. A number of the women in the crowd began cheering and clapping as we walked swiftly away. When I heard a police car approaching, I was suddenly filled with dread. I disengaged from the crowd cleanly, but then every eye in the campo was on me as we walked swiftly toward our apartment. We ducked into a cafe on the Vicolo del Gallo, where I often took Leah in the afternoon for ice cream. The proprietress was a motherly, solicitous woman who paid great attention to Leah and gave her a piece of candy every time she learned a new Italian word. I ordered a cappuccino for myself and ice cream for my daughter, and failed to note that I had been followed into the cafe by Signor D'Angelo. The signora fixed Leah an ice cream first, then made my cappuccino in that elaborate hissing ceremony that Italians perform with such style. I did not hear or see Mimo D'Angelo buy a bottle of beer or drink it. The next thing I knew, the base of the bottle had caught me just above the eyebrow, and the side of my face went numb as blood poured down it. I caught Mimo's arm on the second downswing, lifted the much smaller man into the air, and laid him down on the zinc bar, flat on his stomach. Leah was screaming, and so was the proprietress, and so was Sophia, and so, it seemed, was half of Rome, as I held Mimo flat on the bar and watched in the mirror the blood run down my face. Then I ran with Mimo, sliding him like a sack of laundry down the bar, picking up speed. For 10 feet I ran with Mimo, knocking off glasses and coffee cups and spoons as I held him by his belt and the back of his shirt. When the bar ended, I let go, and Mimo flew through the air over a table of surprised customers and crashed into a pinball machine in a shower of glass and noise and blood. That night, Leah and I stayed at the Regina Coeli prison on the Tiber River, listening to the Roman women on the Janiculum Hill calling to their lovers in the prison below. A prison doctor sewed up the cut along my eyebrow with 5 stitches and argued with the administrator of the prison that Leah was an orphan whose mother had just died and could not be separated from me for any reason. The guard who took Leah and me to a cell asked me what kind of pasta I would like for dinner, and did I prefer red wine or white with my meal. Later, I wrote an article for European Travel and Life on my stay in prison and awarded the prison restaurant 2 stars. Leah and I were minor celebrities when we walked out of Regina Coeli. The short time in prison had improved my skills in Italian immeasurably, and I suggested a stay in jail as a surefire way to master the language for any American who was serious about being bilingual in a short amount of time. But the most durable result of our incarceration was the status and visibility it granted us as citizens of the piazza. Many of the older men who sat on the bench in front of the palazzo thought that much of the greatness of Italy depended on the firmness with which its men handled its women. In a Mediterranean country, especially in the south of Italy and among certain members of the lower classes, wife-beating is a form of family discipline, like the breaking of mules to work in the fields, and certainly not the business of American tourists. But the women of the piazza were unanimous in their contempt for Mimo and in their boundless admiration for anyone who would shed his blood and spend time in prison in the defense of Italian women. So it was the whole piazza that watched as the stranger followed us out of the piazza this morning and down the Via di Monserrato. Leah was wearing a yellow smock and polished brown leather shoes, and she studied her image in every window she passed. She felt pretty, and her dark hair flashed like a wing in sunlight. Giancarlo, the 40-year-old brain-damaged cripple, called out to us as his exhausted, long-suffering mother wheeled him past the English seminary. No one in the neighborhood knew what would happen to Giancarlo once his mother died, and it was always a relief when they appeared in the streets each morning.
The deaf-mute Antonio waved to us, and I paused to light one of his cigarettes. English seminarians surrounded us on their way to classes, serious boys who rarely smiled and had an odd pallor as though raised deep inside caves.
"Do you think that man wants to kill us, Daddy?"
Leah asked. "No, I think he just wants to know where we live and what we do and where you go to school."
"He already knows that. He followed us on Friday."
"It's nothing to worry about, darling," I said, squeezing my daughter's hand. "He's not going to ruin our walk to school."
At 20 Via de Monserrato, we stepped into a courtyard of deep, spicy shade, and Leah called into the courtyard for the cat, Gerardo, to come out of the garden to receive his morning slice of pepperoni. The cat came to her on the run, with tawny movements of leaf and silk. He accepted the meat greedily from Leah, and took it up the formal stairway inlaid with fragments of marble tablets and partially effaced statuary. The man following us was pretending to read the menu in the trattoria in the small piazza.
"If he eats there, I hope he orders mussels," Leah said.
"Shame on you," I said. An American tourist had just gotten hepatitis after eating mussels at another Roman restaurant.
"I bet he's with the Red Brigades," she said.
"How do you know about the Red Brigades?"
"Maria tells me everything. They killed the Italian Prime Minister and dumped him in the trunk of a car. I'll show you where they left him if you want."
"He's not with the Red Brigades. He dresses too well."
"You should dress better, like an Italian," Leah said.
"I apologize for lacking bella figura, you little turd," I said affectionately.
"That's another 1,000 lira you owe me," she said. "It's not nice to call your own daughter a little turd."
"It's a term of endearment, another way of saying I love you. All dads in the States say that."
"It's gross. No Italian father would ever say that to his daughter. They love their daughters far too much."
"Is that what Maria says?"
"And Sua Rosaria."
"You're absolutely right. From this moment on, I am going to concentrate and get me some of that bella figura."
We weaved our way carefully through the morning traffic, for I knew that a Roman never just drives, he aims, and I am always extraordinarily vigilant when we walk to and from the school.
Once we had seen an English tourist on the Ponte Mazzini throw up his hands in mock surrender and simply stop his car in the middle of the bridge.
When I went to see if I could help, the Englishman said, "This isn't driving, I say it's rugby."
"It's going to be a beautiful day, Daddy," Leah said. "No pollution."
On some days the pollution level was so high that the Hilton was invisible, and I felt comforted that Smog could actually perform a public service.
"St. Peter's Head," she said,
as soon as the dome of St. Peter's came into view above the plain trees along the river. She had confused the words head and dome when we had first moved to Rome, and it was an old joke between us. I looked down at the curve in the Tiber. No river, no matter how polluted or dirty, could quite pull off the trick of being ugly. Few things rivet me like the beauty of moving water.
The man kept his distance and did not even mount the bridge until he saw us walk down the stairs beside the Regina Coeli prison. He was being more cautious now that he knew we were aware he was following us. Perhaps people in the piazza had told him about my throwing Mimo into the pinball machine. We entered the courtyard of Sacro Cuore at the end of the long street, the Via di San Francesco di Sales. Sua Rosaria, a slight but beautiful nun, who had a reputation as one of the best teachers of young children in Rome, saw us approaching. For 3 years she had taught Leah, and the communication between them was immediate and total. The nuns I had known in South Carolina were rancorous creatures, and they had helped poison my odd and tortured Catholic boyhood. Although I knew that it was as impossible to be an ex-Catholic as it was to be an ex-Oriental, I vowed I would never raise Leah as a Catholic. What I had not anticipated was that by living in a Catholic country, she would be unable to avoid the church's magisterial reach. Sua Rosaria swooped out of the schoolhouse doorway and ran toward Leah, who saw her coming, and they rushed into each other's arms like schoolgirls. I was thrilled by the authenticity of this nun's open and complete love for Leah. Sua Rosaria looked at me with bright, flirtatious eyes,
and said she was glad that we were bringing their guest to school again. With her eyes, she made a movement toward the man who had followed us through Rome for the fourth day in a row.
Chia? Sua Rosaria asked.
He'll let me know, I answered in Italian. He wants us to know we're being followed. Maybe today he'll let me know why.
Do you know, Signor McCall, Sua Rosaria said, that you have the smartest, most beautiful little girl in the city of Rome?
Si, Suora, I answered. I'm the luckiest man in the world.
You're the nicest daddy in the world, Leah said, hugging me.
Now that's how you can earn some real money, Tiger. Keeping me from cussing's just small potatoes.
Be careful of that man, Leah said. If you die, Daddy, I'll be all alone.
Nothing's gonna happen, I promise. I said goodbye and passed out of the convent grounds, taking a quick survey of the street. Young ballerinos were making their way in those floating, ethereal walks of dances to the studio in the middle of the Via di Francesco di Sales, and young art students were slouching and smoking on the art school steps. But there was no trace of the follower. I waited for a full minute, then saw a quick movement of a man's head appear in the doorway of a bar across from the ballet school, and just as quickly disappear. I had put on my running shoes that morning, and I broke into a slow trot along one of those straight, comely Roman streets with high walls and no exits, and approached the café. As I entered, the man gestured to me to join him at the bar.
"I've already ordered you a cappuccino, Signor McCall," he said pleasantly.
"You've been scaring my daughter, Sherlock. I want it to stop."
"You take one sugar in your cappuccino, I believe," the man said. "I think I know your habits."
"Do you know of my tendency to kick ass when I get nervous?"
"Your propensity for violence has been described to me often, but I am a veteran of many self-defense courses, taekwondo, jiu-jitsu, karate. I have many black belts in my closet. I've been trained by masters to run from danger. But now let us have our coffee, no?" the man continued. "Then we will get up to business."
"I didn't know they had private eyes in Italy," I said, as the bartender passed me a cup of cappuccino across the counter. The man tested his coffee by sipping a spoonful of it and nodding his head appreciatively.
"We are like priests. People only come to us when they are in trouble. My name is Pericle Storacci. I have an office in Milano, but I like to travel around Italy because of my interest in Etruscan art."
"Why are you following me, Pericle?"
"Because I was paid to do so."
"Back to square one. Who sent you?"
"She would like to arrange a meeting with you."
"Who is it?"
"She wants to sign a peace treaty."
"My mother, my goddamn untrustworthy, backstabbing, pain-in-the-ass mother."
"It's not your mother," Pericle said.
"Then it's my father-in-law."
"No," Pericle said. "It is his daughter."
"Martha," I said, surprised. "Why in hell would Martha hire you?"
"Because no one would give her your address. Your family would not cooperate with her."
"Good," I said. "That's the first nice thing I've heard about my family in years."
"She needs to talk to you."
"Tell her I wouldn't see her or any member of her family if God himself typed me out a note on his personal computer. Surely she's told you that."
"She told me there was a great misunderstanding that she thinks can be cleared up."
"There's no misunderstanding," I said, getting ready to leave. "I made a vow never to see those people again. It's the easiest promise to keep I've ever made. The second easiest was the promise never to see any of my own family again. I'm very democratic. I don't want to see a fucking soul who ever spoke English to me during my first 30 years on Earth."
"Signora Fox understands now that you were not responsible for her sister's death."
"Tell her thanks, and that I don't hold her responsible for the depletion of the ozone level, or the melting of the polar ice cap, or the rising price of pepperoni. Nice talking to you, Pericle." I stood up and walked out into the street.
"She has some information," Pericle said, struggling to keep up. "Something she says you will want to know. It is news of some woman, a woman of coins, I think she calls it."
I stopped when he spoke those words. They went through me like shrapnel. "Tell Martha I'll meet her tonight for dinner. I'll be at Da Fortunato's, near the Pantheon."
"I already have, Signor McCall," Pericle said smoothly. "See, I told you, I know all your habits."
Chapter 2 When friends come to Rome in early summer to visit me, I like to take them to the Pantheon during thunderstorms and stand them beneath the opening of the feathery, perfectly proportioned dome as rain falls through the open roof against the marble floor and lightning scissors through the wild and roiled skies. The Emperor Hadrian rebuilt the temple to honor gods no longer worshipped, but you can feel the brute passion in that ardor in the Pantheon's grand and harmonious shape. I think gods have rarely been worshipped so well. On my first trip to Rome, I spent a whole day studying the interior and exterior architecture of the Pantheon for an article I was writing for Southern Living. When the guard ran me out an hour before sunset, I looked around the neighborhood for a good restaurant for dinner that night. Sharla walked from our hotel to join me after spending the day shopping on the Via Condotti. She had bought herself a scarf and a pair of shoes from Ferragamo for her small, beautiful feet, which were her special vanity. Suddenly, on the Via del Pantheon, the air filled with a strange, musky, underground perfume that neither of us recognized. Like two bird dogs, we set out on the trail of the scent and found its origin by the entranceway of Da Fortunato. A basket of white truffles exuded the biting, exotic smell that seemed a transubstantiation of some essence of the forest to the garlic-scented, wine-splashed airstreams pillowing through the alley outside the Trattoria. We returned that evening after making love in our hotel room. Afterward, we had held each other tightly, still surprised and shy by how high we could turn up the flame of that tender need we showed for each other's bodies. At certain times in our lives, we crackled in the sheer electricity of our desire to be wonderful in bed. In strange cities, alone, we whispered things we would not tell another soul on earth. We set down feasts for each other and treated our love with tongues of fire. Our bodies were fields of wonder to us. The waiter, Fernando, but nicknamed Freddy, served us dinner that night. He was heavy-set and deep-voiced and in perfect command of his quadrant of the restaurant. He led us to the small table outside, looking out toward the Pantheon, and recommended a bottle of Barolo and a risotto for the pasta course. When he brought the risotto, he produced an elegant, razor-sharp instrument and shaved thin slices of white truffle onto the steaming hot risotto. The marriage of rice and truffle exploded in silent concordat, and I shall never forget lifting the bowl to my nose and thanking God for bringing both Freddy and truffles into our life the same night. The dinner was long, and we took our time. We talked about the past and the many things that had gone wrong between us, but quickly we turned to the future and began to talk about children and what we would name them and where we would settle down and how we would raise these ethereal and beautiful McCall children who, though unborn, were already greatly beloved. Sharla flirted with Freddy every time he came to the table, and Freddy responded with a touch of both restraint and Mediterranean charm. He recommended the fresh scampi, grilled briefly, then anointed with olive oil and lemon juice. The olive oil was a deep green and looked as though it had come from a vineyard of emeralds. The scampi tasted sweet like a lobster fed only on honey, and it cut into the deep undertone of flavor deposited on the taste buds by the truffles. Sharla poured some olive oil on her fingers and licked it off. Then she poured some on my fingers and sucked the oil off them one at a time as Freddy watched with envy and approval. He honored her performance with an arugula salad, then pulled out a pocket knife, opened it, and began to undress a blood-red orange from Sicily in a patient, sacramental ceremony. The orange peel curled off the deep ruby of the fruit in a long, circular ribbon. I waited for Freddy to misjudge, but he continued to circumnavigate the orange until other patrons began to applaud. When the peel, as long as a garter snake, fell to the floor, Freddy picked it up and presented it to Sharla, who inhaled the sharp smell as Freddy divided the orange and set it before her in an immaculate arrangement, pretty as a rose. He brought glasses impressed with the image of the Pantheon and poured us both a glass of grappa. A full moon hung over the city, and a gypsy girl selling long-stemmed flowers moved nimbly through the diners. Three men from Abruzzi sang Neapolitan love songs, then passed the hat for tips, and a fire-eater swallowed his flaming sword, and a man with a ukulele sang, "I want to hold your hand," and "Love me tender."
"This is just like a Fellini movie, Jack," Shiloh said. "Let's never leave this spot."
Crowds of Italian teenagers, insouciant and callow, moved through the streets into the Piazza della Rotonda in ceaseless migrations. Gypsy women appeared in brilliant, gaudy clothing, raucous as parrots, and began working the loungers at the cafe as waiters tried to intercept them. Carriages drawn by retired racehorses put out into the streets and rolled through the crowds, bearing German and Japanese tourists, who were filming everything and seeing nothing. At the end of the evening, Freddy brought two cups of espresso to the table and asked us always to remember Da Fortunato and the head waiter, Freddy, who'd been privileged to serve us on a Roman night that he called Fantastica. Shala kissed Freddy in a spontaneous gesture that seemed just right. As I was studying the bill, Shala pressed my hand and told me to look up. What I saw was Freddy leading Federico Fellini and two of the most stunning women I had ever seen to the table next to us. Freddy winked and said, "Always at Da Fortunato." Then Freddy, who understood the power of gesture, bought a rose from a gypsy girl and presented it to Shala along with a wine glass from Da Fortunato. After Shala died, I found that glass and that dead rose and the orange peel carefully wrapped and preserved in her safety deposit box. They reminded me that there are nights on Earth when a couple can have everything break perfectly for them, nights when the moon is full and gypsies appear with flowers and truffles call out to strangers on the street, and Fellini takes the next table, and Freddy peels a blood-red orange as an act of homage. And on that night in Rome, we were in love as no one on earth has any right to hope to be. We conceived our child, Leah, in a union of ineffable and damaged love, and a great soaring cry of yes for our future. 2.5 years later, Shiloh went up on the bridge. On this evening, many years later, Freddy embraced me when I walked into the restaurant and kissed me on both cheeks, European style.
"Dove Lia?" Freddy asked.
"She's at home with Maria.
A beautiful signorina is waiting at your table."
Martha stood up as I approached her. She extended her hand and I accepted it reluctantly. She did not try to kiss me, nor would I have let her.
"It's nice of you to come, Jack," Martha Fox said.
"It certainly is, Martha.
I didn't think you'd actually show.
If I hadn't, you'd have ambushed Leah one day when she was out walking in the piazza."
"You're right. That's exactly what I would have done. What a beautiful girl she's turned into."
"I don't want to be your friend, Martha," I said. "What in the fuck are you doing here, and why are you trying to re-enter my life? I've made it abundantly clear that I didn't want to see you or any of your family again."
"Are you ever going to come back to the South? Are you ever going to show Leah where she really comes from?"
"That's none of your business," I answered.
"I was once your sister-in-law. I admit I never knew you well, but I liked you, Jack. Almost all of us did."
"Well, it seems to me that the last time I saw you, Martha, you were testifying in a court of law that I was unfit to raise Leah." Martha lowered her eyes and studied the menu for a brief moment. I motioned for Freddy to bring us a bottle of wine, and he arrived a moment later and opened a chilled bottle of Gavi de Igavi.
"That was a terrible mistake," she said emotionally. "My parents were distraught when Shala killed herself. Surely you can understand that and have some compassion for them. Leah was their only link with Shala in the past."
"I'd have had more compassion for them if they'd shown the slightest bit toward me."
"I think my whole family had a breakdown after Shala's death, Jack," Martha said. "Everybody blamed you for what happened, myself included. We thought if you'd been a good enough husband, my sister would never have gone off the bridge. No one blames you for anything now. Except, of course, my father."
"Give me some good news," I said. "Tell me that son of a bitch is dead."
"I love my father very much, and I resent you talking about him that way."
"Tough shit."
"My father is a very unhappy man," Martha said, leaning across the table toward me. "But he's got good reasons for his unhappiness, and you know that as well as anyone."
"Just for the record, I hate your dutiful daughter routine,
and you don't have to act like a public relations firm for your parents. Now let's order." When Freddy came over, he studied Martha's face.
"Sorella di Shaila?"
Freddy asked me. "Martha, meet Freddy. He had a crush on your sister."
"Ah, Martha, your sister was such a beauty, such a sunshine. You look so much like her,"
Freddy said, bowing deeply.
"I'm pleased to meet you, Freddy. You're very famous in South Carolina."
"Oh, we have some nice fat mussels, Jack. Fresh anchovies, very nice. Calamari fritti. What would the Martha like? Maybe pasta alla matriciana."
"I'd love to start with the pasta, Freddy," Martha said.
"Anything for the sister of Shaila. Welcome to the trattoria. Come back 1,000 times. Mussels for you, Signor Jack. Trust Freddy." Freddy moved back toward the kitchen, checking every table as he passed, and I smiled at his proficiency. Freddy was like a staff sergeant in the army. Others enjoy greater status, but without him, the whole operation would come to a grinding halt. I turned and looked at Martha, seeing those soft, luminous features she shared with her sister. She had the same doe-eyed, self-conscious beauty that in Shaila was edgy and explosive. In Martha, it held its breath, tiptoed into view, took one by surprise whenever she released that tightly coiled spring that controlled the nerve centers of her own quiet uncertainty. Even makeup could not hide the trapped, distracted girl masquerading with pearls and a black dress as a woman of the world.
"My father still blames you for Shaila's death," Martha said. "It's only fair that you know that."
"You know, Martha," I said wearily, "I always thought I'd make a great son-in-law. Fishing trips, card games, that kind of shit. And I get stuck with that dreary, juiceless, raggedy-assed father of yours. I could never figure him out. But you know all this. You grew up in that hothouse of pain."
"Why do you hate me for loving my father?" she asked.
"Because of your pathetic lack of honesty, the awful and dangerous pretense of loyalty. He's been poison for you just like he was poison for Shaila and your mother. The women in his life cluster around him, protect him, find virtue in his bitterness. You don't love him, you pity him, the way I do. Yet I've rarely met a grander shit on earth."
"Why do you hate him so much?"
"I pity the dreadful son of a bitch. He doesn't need your pity. Then he's welcome to my hatred." Freddy arrived with Martha's pasta and my mussels, and his arrival was both propitious and welcome. Her dish was sharp, spicy, and even had the forbidden pleasure of containing the flesh of hogs. Though a committed Jew, Martha found no reason to follow the dietary laws handed down in Leviticus. For most of her adult life, she had fought border skirmishes with her parents over the pig and the oyster. Judaism was precious to her, but she could not pretend to be observant of its many dietary laws.
"May I try one of your mussels?" she asked.
"Pure treif," I said, passing her one.
"But delicious," she said as she ate it.
"What are you doing here, Martha?" I asked. "You haven't quite answered that very basic question."
"I want to understand why my sister leapt to her death. I want someone to explain to me why her life had become so desperate when she seemed to have so much going for her. Nothing about it makes sense. My parents won't talk about it."
"I can understand that. I haven't told Leah that her mother committed suicide. I just never could quite get my mouth right to tell her about the bridge. It's been hard enough to tell her that her mama's dead."
"Does she know that I'm alive? That she has an aunt and two grandparents who love her?"
"A vague idea," I said. "But I'm encouraging pure amnesia. Please don't look pious. Last time I saw the people you just mentioned was in a South Carolina court of law. If memory serves, each one of you testified I was incompetent to raise my only child. I've raised a beautiful kid, a magical one. I did it without the help of any of you.
You think it's right that you punish us the rest of our lives by refusing to let us see Leah?" she asked.
"Yes, I think it's right. I think it's justice. Do you remember the generous amount of visitation I'd have been allowed had your parents won their lawsuit?"
"They asked the court that you not be allowed any visitation," Martha said, closing her eyes and inhaling deeply. "They know how wrong they were. They would like another chance."
At that moment, Freddy arrived at the table with two grilled sea bream. He prepared the fish for presentation at tableside, removing the head of both fish with a flick of the knife. Then he skinned the brim and lifted the backbone from each one of them, as though lifting a violin out of its case. Preparing Martha's first, he placed the white, translucent fillet across her plate and moistened it with green olive oil and half a lemon. He performed the same ablutions for mine. "You will cry," Freddy said. "It is so good."
"Did I order fish?"
Martha asked when Freddy left the table. "You looked like a fish kind of person. He has great intuition, and he always likes to surprise me." As she ate, Martha frequently stared past me, and when she talked, she was agitated and kept brushing an imaginary lock of hair from her eyes. Hers was a guileless face, registering every emotion, and I could read it like a page of newsprint. Something was not right with Martha that had nothing to do with the complex emotions aroused by our awkward reunion. The lines in her forehead warned me of trouble on my flanks. Since leaving the South, I had learned the intricacies and tricks of a life on the run, and I knew well how to read the secret language of ambush. "Excuse me for a second," I said, rising and walking to the men's room. I called home and talked to Maria and made a check on Leah. Maria returned to report that Leah was sleeping like an angel, and I breathed easier.